This is Recovery Radio, the first radio show men and women island to offer useful information for the purpose of helping men and women suffering from alcohol and other addictions. Recovery Radio's goal is to raise awareness in the state and is dedicated to improving the outcome of those with addictions. Recovery Radio, hosted by John Tassoni, is presented by Phoenix House of New England. Call John now at 437-5000 or 888-345-0790. Now, John Tassoni.
Welcome to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, John Tassoni. We have Dr. Dan Edmonds on the line, and Dr. Dan is a psychotherapist, and also he's an author of a book, Meaning and the Art of Recovery. Welcome, doctor, and thank you for joining us today.
Yes, thank you.
Now, doctor, so my listeners know where you are, where you're at, and what state you're in. Why don't you give us a little background?
I'm in Northeast Pennsylvania, and I work as a psychotherapist, and I'm also a certified advanced alcohol and drug counselor, and I work in a residential program as well.
Well, very good. And again, thank you so much for joining us today. This is your second time on the show, and I want to thank you for all that you do for the people of Pennsylvania and people that are in recovery. So let's talk a little bit about your book. I haven't read it, to be honest with you. I haven't read it. So give us a little background on your book, how you became associated with recovery, and let's move from there.
Well, part of it is based on personal experience, but it's also encounters that I've had with individuals over time. And what I began to realize it was a common theme that kept popping up. And there were three things that I saw: that within addiction, there was a lack of three crucial things. One was meaning, another was identity, and the other was validation. And what I saw in that was it led to this desire to escape. But the attempts to escape usually led one to kind of enslavement from one thing to another. Mm-hmm. So in the crisis of meaning, one, they're beginning to question not only their purpose, but who they are, where they're going. And they begin to have regrets about where they've been, and sometimes that often causes them to kind of go nowhere. So when they begin to serve others, help others, and create meaning, then they begin to develop more of a sense of purpose, and the identity kind of follows from there. Mm-hmm. And within that lack of meaning, there tends to be this void. So people are looking for something to fill that with. So then the question becomes, are they going to fill it with the junk food that kind of alleviates the hunger, but never really satisfies, or is it going to be something that can actually provide them some type of real nourishment? Mm-hmm. And as far as where they'll go, this becomes a choice for them where the path can be less tedious and is more fulfilling if the journey takes place with others, rather than isolation. So that's kind of a focus of my book as well, is kind of the journey together through the process of overcoming addiction, and how this process is not something that can be done in isolation, can be done alone. I look at when one walks alone, that they're more likely that they're going to become lost, and that there's not going to be anybody really there to nurse the wounds along the way.
Right. How much research, doctor, did it take to write this book? I'm sure when you write a book, it's a huge undertaking. So how much research did you have to put into this book?
This came from just quite a while of just kind of collecting stories of hearing this common theme, and then and then I began to kind of to examine and do a little bit of background and see that the things that I saw as these common themes were things that were talked about by others as well. And the other thing that I began to kind of conclude as a common theme is that in some situations, there might have been traumatic experience at the root of the addiction, but not always. But what I did find was that there was always a painful experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw that if one wants to understand addiction, they have to be willing to understand that painful experience. They have to be willing to kind of venture into that darkness and realize that there's a lot of folks who are afraid to walk into the light. So some tend to judge and they fail to grasp how many can return to that same cycle, that same addictive behavior time and time again.
Mm.
But I saw too that it's the human condition for us to return to that which was familiar, even though it might be uncomfortable.
Right.
So we have to come to know kind of the forces which led to the disintegration of one's identity, what caused them to fail to grasp meaning, what caused them to have that isolation, even though they might have been among others. I touch on in the book as well kind of the idea of being alone and how this, there's three aspects to that, that there's the obvious being alone and being in isolation, which can lead to depression and a whole number of other things.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also that, which I find to be worse, of that being alone but not believing that you're alone, that you have others around you. So when one's in active addiction, oftentimes they may have individuals around them, but the focus, those are not actually genuine relationships.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be centered on solely one thing. So I see that as a worse form of being alone. And then there's the alone of just being in solitude and reflection, and I see that as a very positive and sometimes disregarded means of being alone.
When you were doing your research and talking to different people, did they say to you that they didn't realize the amount of agony that they were inflicting on, whether it be relatives, friends, wives, husbands?
I found that some were somewhat aware that these things were occurring, but they said that they often felt trapped and unable to be able to really do anything about that situation.
Mm-hmm.
That basically the addiction had kind of taken hold of their lives in such a way that they didn't really see a way out. Even if, and I think I see it too, is there, that there is this line between abuse and dependency. And I think that when an individual crosses that line into dependency, all of their best efforts and so forth, and I believe that these individuals are very sincere. And I think some looking at that from the outside, it causes them some frustration because they're saying, okay, well, they're telling me that they want to be different. They're telling me they want to change this, but it's not always changing. So are they sincere? Are they genuine? And I found that I believe that they are, but they're such in that, when they cross that line of dependence, they're such in a grip of this that despite all of their efforts, it's not going to happen without certain components. And as I said, that sense of community, it can't be something that they're going to overcome alone.
Right. All right, we're going to take a quick break, Doctor. We'll be right back. You're listening to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Sean Tassone. We'll be right back. Phoenix Health of New England, a national nonprofit leader in the treatment of substance use disorders and co-occurring behavioral health issues. Phoenix Health provides comprehensive care for medically monitored withdrawal, available in Rhode Island and now a new facility in Quincy, Massachusetts, to residential and outpatient treatment and recovery housing for adults. For teens, we offer both intensive outpatient treatment and comprehensive outpatient services. At Phoenix House, our highly professional staff is committed to helping you achieve a better way of life through recovery. Major insurance plans and credit cards are accepted, and a sliding fee scale is available. So give us a call at 1-800-DRUG-HELP. That's 1-800-378-4435, or go online and visit us at phoenixhouse.org. Take your first step to the path to recovery today. Phoenix Health of New England, accredited by the CARF, the Commission on Accreditation and Rehabilitation Facilities, is a national standard of excellence. Phoenix Health of New England is a proud sponsor of Recovery Radio. We're talking to Dr. Dan Edmonds, all the way from the great state of Pennsylvania. Welcome, doctor, and thank you for joining us again.
Yes, thank you.
I want to ask you, in your research, doing the book, and your daily life as a recovery specialist and a psychotherapist, why would you write a book at this particular point?
I felt the need. I had been putting my thoughts down for some time in regard to these matters, and I just felt the need to. It was kind of a bit of service, is how I looked at it. That I wanted to offer something that would give a perspective on addiction. And also, one of my objectives was to try to kind of break through some misunderstandings about addiction and some of the stigma that's attached to it.
Do you think you accomplished that?
I believe that I have done something, hopefully, that can help dispel some of the misunderstandings and also offer some hope to those that are struggling with addiction. Mm-hmm. Do I think I have tackled the entire problem? No. And I think there's a lot more work to be done in that regard. Mm. One of the things that I'll mention, too, with which I kind of have discussed in the book is that, and I think this is important as well, is that there tends to be sometimes this divide made between addiction and mental health.
Right.
And I find the two to be very intertwined, and it's often the challenging state of mind which paves the way to addiction to begin with. And then once the addiction arises, then, of course, there's the greater deterioration of one's mental state, where the end result for a lot of folks, unfortunately, is complete despair. So I think it's necessary not only to support the person who's in difficult emotional states, whether addiction arose or not, but also take on the role of an activist. So that was part of the goal in writing this as well, is that in addition to my clinical role, I think it's important for me and others to take that aggravation, so to kind of seek to change the dynamics that are going on, which lead people into such states. And I think some may ask, well, why do some go through painful or difficult experience and addiction arises, whereas in some situations it does not?
Right.
And I think the fact is that everyone is going to react to oppressive dynamics. Some become depressed, some become anxious, some even become psychotic. Some will develop addiction. So it's each based on what is available or not available at the time, and each is usually ill-fated attempt to alleviate what they consider to be an unbearable situation.
You know, I over the past few weeks here in Rhode Island, I've seen a lot of young adults, and it's hard to pinpoint the older adults have fallen in the trap of this epidemic of overdose. And I sit every morning, I go to a couple of different coffee places and talk to different people pertaining to the, you know, the daily events, obviously on the national level in Rhode Island. But the stigma end of it seems to be so entrenched in people's brains that it's very difficult to get it out of their brains, because you hear the comments all the time around the table. Who cares? We just lost another dope addict. Who cares? You know, those people, that's all they want to do is just hang around, smoke pot, take opioids. They don't want to be productive citizens. But they don't get the whole aspect of what's transpiring in these people's brains. Because it very, very easily could be, and I say this all the time, and I say it on the radio all the time, it very easily could be your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, or your kids.
Right, and see, that's one of the goals that I had, too, is that, and I find this lacking, both in the realm of work with those struggling with addiction, and also in the mental health field, is the validation of experience. So that is what I was trying to do as well, is to be faithful to these individuals' experience.
Right.
So as I was writing, I have my own personal experience, but I didn't want it to be just my own experience, but I wanted to relate. And so before I even put this out there, I shared what I wrote with many others and asked for feedback. Mm-hmm. And said, the things that I'm putting forward, does this make sense to you? Does this relate to your experience? One of the other things tied in with stigma that I see as a big problem, too, is I have seen programs that are supposedly about helping others it's based on this idea of confrontation, that using a confrontational approach with the individual, that somehow that this is going to be beneficial to them. But I find that certainly not to be the case at all. And I think that the things that sometimes I believe that the potential of the individual is there during the time of active addiction, there may be kind of this stunting of emotional development. There may be kind of a shutting off of some of those qualities that they could demonstrate.
Mm-hmm.
But the only way to be able to really help that individual is by modeling those very things that it maybe at that moment that they appear to be lacking.
Mm-hmm.
Be that compassion and patience. Mm. So we have to kind of to enter their world to be able to understand some of the feelings of hopelessness and despair that they have. So I think a confrontational approach is only going to give rise to retaliation, denial. It's going to cause defensiveness. So an approach of service based on just core human values of benevolence, that's going to give rise to a restoration of these individuals' full humanity, a feeling that they are truly human beings again.
Mm-hmm.
and being authentic with
right.
them, genuine. Well, mm-hmm. it's going to give rise to honest interactions. And if we give supportive guidance rather than being judgmental, that's going to give rise to them being more able to be functionally independent and have better decision-making. If we're showing examples of humility and kindness, then likewise, they're going to begin to adopt the same. And I look at it, too, as a process of unlearning. So many times, the substance became what they turned to be able to cope. And it might have been all that they knew at that time, and it might have initially been effective for them. But later, as it progressed, became very destructive. So to be able to guide them through this process of unlearning and to adopt new ways of coping with life, to not run away from life, not to be afraid of life, but to get to the point of actually finding life beautiful and to be embraced rather than avoided.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to take a quick break. I want to you hit on a word that's been sticking in my claw that I want to talk to you about when we come back, and that is compassion. You're listening to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Sean Tassone. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, John Tassone. Dr. Dan Edmonds is on the line. Dr. Dan is all the way from the great state of Pennsylvania. Welcome, doctor, and thank you for joining us again.
Yes, thank you again.
I want to talk to you about the word compassion. So many times where different places that I visit, whether it be treatment facilities, outpatient services, my radio show, and other venues that I frequent pertaining to my work, there's not a lot of compassion in the area of people who need recovery or, in fact, are in treatment. So many times, and it's not only for people who are in recovery, it's for the homeless community. It's for a few other organizations. And people just think that these people are freeloaders. Excuse me. Freeloaders. They think that they have no control over substances, alcohol, gambling issues. They just think that they're people that shouldn't even be on the face of the earth. And I look at it this way, because maybe because I was brought up different. My parents always instilled in me to help the people who are less fortunate than I am. And that's why I'm in this radio business that I'm in with recovery. I work with the Substance Use Mental Health Leadership Council. I'm lobbying up at the State House for SAM, Smart Approaches to Marijuana. I'm not in recovery, although I had an uncle who had an issue with alcohol, but wasn't really that close to me. But I just feel as though they need a voice to go out there and pound the pavement and get other people to realize that, number one, this is a sickness, and number two, there is hope in recovery.
Right. I do think that, as I mentioned, the whole need to validate experience, and I think there's a lot of assumptions made, but most that are making those assumptions really have not come to know what the experience of these individuals is really all about.
Right.
And sadly, what I'm finding, too, is that sometimes you have policies that tend to be more reactive rather than proactive. And some of these policies, they're only picking up a fragment of the pieces once there's been damage done, and they're not doing anything more. And then they're sending persons back to environments and dynamics which led to breakdown to begin with.
Right.
So I think that's an important component, too, is that in addition to providing treatment to the individual, if we can begin to do things that change the environment and the dynamics that are around that person, that is going to be powerful as well. And so we see that there'll be individuals that they may be in a treatment center or whatever, and they follow the regimen, and then that leads to discharge. But they're sent back to these situations where there's still kind of oppressive dynamics there that is only going to kind of lead them backwards. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to be really focused on issues of social justice. We have to look at issues of inequality as well, and then take those things into consideration. Mm. Sadly, I hear attitudes of that. So if an addict were to, there was a death of an addict from an overdose or whatever, well, they were a drug addict. Or if we find a person who has a mental health issue, oh, well, they were just not normal people. Mm-hmm. It's looked at that we're not going to really treat them as fellow human beings. But if we can come to a point where we have an understanding of our common humanity and that we can see that these people are our neighbors, that these are our brothers, these are our sisters, then, and take the time to really delve into it and to journey with them and then to know and understand their painful experience and hopefully try to bring them to some sense of joyful experience through our connection with them.
Right. I want to get, because you touched on another subject that's been a thorn in my side since I got out of legislature in 2012. I was the sponsor and originator of the Recovery High School here in Rhode Island. And I kept telling the people during the testimony to try to get it passed that if these kids go to the Recovery High School and take English, they take math, they take classes, they're evaluated, they have substance abuse treatment, and then at night they go back to the same environment, what you do during the day is not helping them at night. Because they're going back,
right.
they could be doing substances with their parents, they can be doing substances with their friends, their relatives. So it's the whole thing, in my eyes, doesn't work. And I'll tell you why I think that. I was a business agent for Council 94 here in Rhode Island, which is a state municipal union. And I had the training school. And I used to talk to those boys all the time when I went there. And I said, listen, if you don't straighten out, the next step is when you're 18, you're going to end up at the adult correctional institution. But they always used to tell me, I can't straighten out because once I leave here, I go back to the streets again. I have to live with gangs. I have to live with the people that are running rampant in the communities that they live in. There's no escape from that. And I think that we can make a difference with substance abuse if we had residential treatment where these people could stay on, especially the kids, get some good, I'll use the word good time, and then go home every other weekend or one weekend a month so they're not going back every night to the same environment. I think we would get better results if that happens.
Absolutely, and that's something that I focus on is that I really do believe that you are taking this limited period of time and trying to teach some new skills. But if the majority of their time is spent in this situation that is all too familiar to them, that is going to be overwhelming for one, and it's going to override any possibility of instilling those new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's completely counterproductive. So I look at the recovery can't be compartmentalized. It can't be okay. Well, we're going to talk recovery and we're going to do recovery related things just for a few hours and then we're going to, we'll ship you back into the world that you are not prepared exactly to encounter.
And, Doc, can I just step in for a second? I had a young man who is obviously at the age of 18 now. When he was 12, he was doing heroin with his parents at 12. Sticking needles in his arm at 12. And that young man said to us here on the radio that, you know, your mom and dad are doing it, so you must think it's okay to do it. And then when he went into treatment and he had to go back to the same environment, the mom and dad were still doing what they were doing. So he felt as though there was no way out until he got to the age of 18. And then he had a, and I don't want to use this negatively, but he had a mind of his own. He wasn't being drawn in by the parents, you know, because you're living under my roof, you need to do this, 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 and this. I can't imagine how many kids are stuck in that situation today.
Right. And what I've seen, too, and I'll make a point of this, is some individuals early on who the messages that are sent to them is that somehow that they are bad people, that there is something seriously wrong with them, and that there's no validation. So what I see happening is that some of these individuals will begin to make some positive changes in their lives, but these things, there's no support really, and there's no recognition of them. So they begin to become disillusioned once again, and they're thinking, well, I've tried to make these changes. Nobody is supporting me.
Nobody's
recognizing that I've done any of this. And they're telling me that I am this terrible person. So maybe that's what I really am, and I'll just be that.
Right.
So then that is where the relapse potential becomes extremely high, because they look at that. Why should I bother to try if there is going to be no validation?
Right. I think you hit the nail right on the head. And we're going to take another quick break. You're listening to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Sean Tassone. We'll be right back. Take your first step to the path to recovery today. Call Phoenix House at 1-800-DRUG-HELP, a national nonprofit leader in the treatment of substance use disorders and co-occurring behavioral health issues. Phoenix House provides comprehensive care for adults, from medically monitored withdrawal services available in Rhode Island, our new facility in Quincy, Massachusetts, to residential and outpatient treatment and recovery housing for adults. For teens, we offer both intensive outpatient treatment and comprehensive outpatient services. At Phoenix House, our highly professional staff is committed to helping you achieve a better way of life through recovery. Major insurance plans and credit cards are accepted, and a sliding fee scale is available. So give us a call at 1-800-DRUG-HELP. That's 1-800-378-4435. Or go online and visit us at phoenixhouse.org. Phoenix House of New England, accredited by the CARF, the Commission on Accreditation and Rehabilitation Facilities, is a national standard of excellence. Phoenix House of New England is the proud sponsor of Recovery Radio. Dr. Dan Edmonds is on the line all the way from the lovely state of Pennsylvania. Welcome, doctor, and thank you for joining us again today.
Thanks.
Doc, I want to hit a little bit on the overdose numbers. In Rhode Island, from 2015 to 2016, we had an increase of 12%. Are you able to share, or do you know about Pennsylvania and what is going on over there?
I do know within the area that I'm in, the county that I personally reside in, that we are having an overdose. Basically, it's being reported about every 3 to 4 days. That we're finding that, and what is rather unfortunate is that when you look in the newspaper at obituaries, you can decipher and know what situation by the language and the way that it's written that was an overdose, but I think there. It ties into the stigma that no one is really wanting to say that's what actually occurred.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've seen some obituaries, but relatively very few, saying at the bottom, please send your donations to whether it be Phoenix House or any other residential treatment provider. I've seen very little of that. And they try to mask the problem in the obituary area. So I look at it a couple of ways. Number one, I think the stigma and the embarrassment to families when something like this happens, they don't want to let the neighbors know, their friends know. But it's almost, and I'll use this word, a way of life now, where, you know, this is happening throughout the country. If this was an epidemic like we saw of the AIDS virus, and some of the other major epidemics that the country's had, and the amount of money that's been pumped into AIDS research and stuff like that is phenomenal, and now all of a sudden we have it under control. If this was a diabetes outbreak where multitude of hundreds of thousands of people would get diabetes, they would dump money into that. I don't see the states or the federal government jumping in with their 2 feet. I've been saying all along here in Rhode Island, we should be starting to do public service announcements to let people know where they can go to get help. And that has fallen on deaf ears. I mean, I run this show here. Imagine if I didn't have the show. We're up to 14,000 listeners now. So where would these 14,000 people go to get information about substance use, mental health, gambling? It's not a fancy-dancy issue. But people need to know where they need to go for treatment and help.
Right, and that's the thing, that I think that there sometimes the information is limited, or as I mentioned earlier, that it always tends to be a reactive response than a proactive response.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what I see in my area as far as how government entities respond to this. That there's really nothing. Usually they're dealing with problems once they have already occurred, rather than looking at what can we do to address this from the beginning and to support individuals and to create an awareness.
I there's got to be more of an effort from the government side, the prevention side, the people who run treatment facilities. And I say this because I was being in the legislature for 12 years. If it doesn't affect anybody up at that building, it's hard to get people's attention. We're just starting to get people's attention now because friends and family are dying of overdoses. And I'm gonna leave it at that. Doctor, I want to thank you for joining us today. Love to have you back on. I'll be in touch.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All the way from Pennsylvania, Dr. Dan Edmonds. You'll listen to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, John Tassone. We'll see you next week.